as I've grown up, I've grown up like a lot of us, I think, in the church and in and around sermons and religion and all that sort of stuff. And I've never been a big fan of preachers who use gardening metaphors. Being a person who viewed gardening as something that I was forced to participate in by my parents, I would say that I've often found the use of gardening as a metaphor a bit alienating over the years. But as a sure sign that I am getting older, I am going to talk about gardening. And then we're going to talk about Jesus' parable of the sower and the way it connects through Ernest Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea to a consideration of privilege that we have in this world. So as a quick digression, some of you know that I've spent the last few years working on a PhD dissertation, which is on Hemingway. Currently, I am prepping for my final defense. So as you can imagine, it's taking up a lot of my brain power. In fact, I've even made a pie chart here, because I know that we all love pie charts, Karen especially, which will show you exactly how much of my brain is being taken up by Hemingway. The blue is Hemingway. This orange little strip here is everything else. So I can post that later in the comments if you want to take a closer look at what's going on in my head, but I wouldn't suggest it. Anyway, to be honest, all of this stuff that's kind of going on, and I agreed to speak at this time, I got it done, but you're all kind of lucky I'm not just reading a chapter from my dissertation, because, you know, I was tempted. But anyway, as I mentioned in the blurb, the other thing that's been going on in my life besides PhD prep and, you know, raising children and living through a pandemic has been that I've been waging a strange battle with my lawn over the past few months. It started with the snow melting to reveal a crusty layer of dry, dead leaves underneath. Those are leaves that somebody was supposed to rake up last fall. But anyway, when the leaves were finally raked, I discovered this odd patch of totally dead grass. It's a perfect square, about 5 feet by 5 feet, in the far corner of my lawn, my front lawn. And it's bordered on two sides by my neighbor's rock garden and the sidewalk, and on the other two sides by perfectly healthy grass. It's the strangest thing. It's almost like some large, heavy object had been sitting there, a perfectly square object had been sitting there all winter. Adding to my bewilderment over this patch is the fact that last summer, the exact same grass was the healthiest and fullest patch of grass and greenest patch of grass on my whole lawn. In fact, when I would mow it, I could feel the mower start to slow down because it was having such a hard time chomping through these meaty blades of grass. But this year, totally dead. Now, as I said before, I've never cared about grass or lawns before in my life, and yet this patch of grass has become kind of an obsession for me. Now, this is partially for aesthetic reasons and for vanity. When I sit on my porch, I notice people taking notice of the perfect square of dead brown grass, some even slowing down to comment on its odd symmetry. But what really bothered me was what struck me as some sort of insidious insolence on the part of this grass. It's like the grass was aware that, you know, I'm new around here, and so was kind of messing with me, hazing me before I could enter this fraternity of lawn owners, forcing me to tend to it, to do more than just mow it and forget about it. It felt like it was taunting me, trying to make me care about it. Now, being the polar opposite of a green thumb, which if you look at a color wheel, the opposite of green is red, so I guess I'm a red thumb, I obviously had no idea what to do. And like so many things over the course of my life, it was my mother who offered me a possible solution. And by offered me a possible solution, I mean she told me how to fix it, which is usually how that goes. Her advice was two steps. One, buy some grass seed. Two, plant the grass seed. Again, being diametrically opposed to putting any effort into yard work as a principle, I balked at the idea for paying for seeds for grass, which is supposed to just come back on its own. So instead, I called my father-in-law because he had just put in a patch of new grass, and sure enough, he had an extra bag in the garage. So luckily, I didn't have to put any money into this. After a week of procrastinating, I went out one morning and raked up all the dead grass so that there was lots of dirt on top, and began taking handfuls of seed from the bag, making lines of seeds carefully spaced and in multiple directions to ensure sufficient coverage, just like the instructions on the bag had explicitly told me to do. This worked for about half a second, because as anyone who's ever tried to spread seed knows, seeds are very light, especially grass seeds. And even a slight breeze means that they will land wherever they want, regardless of the sower's intention. Then a funny thing happened. As I watched the seeds, watched these tiny seeds sort of blow away, this tangible display of nature mocking my dedication to doing the least amount of work possible, I had a flashback to two TV shows that I used to watch as a kid, shows I haven't thought about in at least 30 years. These two TV shows were called The Flying House and Superbook. Now, both of these were Japanese-produced Christian programs about kids who would travel through time to experience stories from the Bible. I'm mentioning both because I don't actually remember which one of these shows these memories came from. Some of you who grew up in the 80s maybe will remember these shows too. I don't know. I know we saw them because my parents had friends with a probably illegal satellite hookup. And they would give us VHS tapes full of these episodes whenever we would visit. So if you don't know about it, don't worry. You're not missing much. So the image that came to my mind was a retelling of the story of the parable of the sower, a story that Jesus tells in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. I can remember vividly, actually, these sort of animated depictions of happy, innocent little anthropomorphized seeds that were being thrown down to the earth from the hands of some faceless sower before finding themselves in varying environments. Just like the story Jesus tells, a bunch of the seeds missed the soil and landed on the path, where a bunch of terrifying birds started eating them, mercilessly plucking them from the ground and chewing them alive. The next group fell in with some rocks with shallow dirt, but they were able to spring up very quickly. I can vaguely recall the image of some strong-looking plants that were very happy with themselves, proudly boasting of how fast they grew, until the sun comes up and burns them all to death because they were not able to get enough moisture from the shallow dirt. The third group lands among the weeds and thorns, who I remember were very nice to the little seeds at first, letting them get settled in and begin to grow before turning on them as they suffocated the small budding plants. Finally, we got to see the seeds that landed in the good soil. Those are the lucky ones. They each found purchase and grew strong. These plants were able to thrive and multiply because they were in the right spot. So, as I was out there sowing these seeds, watching some of them get blown away onto my neighbor's rock garden and onto the sidewalk, I began to think more about this parable and what it was trying to say. I quickly recalled the very problematic interpretation that I was taught at the very Calvinist school I attended growing up, a school so deeply rooted, no pun intended, in Calvinism that it was actually named after the guy. The idea that was taught to me was one of predestination, that sadistic little bit of theological gobbledygook. In this version, the sower is God, the seeds are people, and the field is the afterlife. Despite the fact that all the seeds are equal, some people are just going to end up getting eaten by birds, choked out by weeds, or burned up by the sun. And there's nothing we can do about it, because that's God's will. I decided to reread the parable, because I thought there had to be more to it than what I was remembering. And sure enough, there is. In fact, in a rare occurrence, Jesus actually offers an explanation of the parable to his disciples. This explanation is quite different from the one that I remember being taught, but it's easy to see how the Calvinists, you know, with their obsession with seeing people burn in hell, got there. Jesus says that he is the sower, and that the seeds are the good news, or gospel, or the message of the kingdom. The different types of ground represent different sorts of people and life circumstances, which affect the ways in which Christ's message is received, and how it affects their lives. The notion of gospel, of the gospel or message or good news, is actually large and complex. So I'm going to circle back to that in a little bit. For now, we can understand Jesus is saying that those who don't really understand the message run the risk of having it snatched away by the evil one or Satan or the spirit of evil, depending on your translation and sort of how you take into consideration those ideas. The shallow soil represents those who get very excited about the message, but don't take the time to gain a deeper understanding, and so drop it as soon as things get tough. The weeds represent the worries and distractions of life that overwhelm the goodness of the kingdom. Interestingly, Jesus includes the lure of wealth as one of the weeds. So take that, prosperity gospel. The good soil represents those who hear the word, take the time to understand it, embody it, and live it out. So depending on what sort of belief system you were raised in, this explanation will likely seem quite exclusionary and fatalistic. It can be understood that Jesus is saying that there are winners and losers, and there is nothing that can be done about it. So if you're a loser, sorry, that's just your lot in life. If you're a winner, don't feel bad. There's nothing you can do to help those losers. There's always going to be losers. Does that feel a little bit gross to you? It does to me. So what if, instead of thinking about some sort of cosmic, eschatological, religious framework, let's think about it in terms of an idea that is quite prevalent in the collected sort of conversations many of us are having today, namely the idea of privilege. So the best place to start, if we're going to do this, is to deconstruct the idea of the kingdom of heaven or the gospel. Oftentimes, at least in the tradition I was raised in, whenever one talked about the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom of God, it was referring to an afterlife, someplace beyond earth, where our souls would live on in either eternal reward or damnation. And I don't want to debate the afterlife, or heaven or hell, or anything like that. Nobody knows what happens after we die, because it's unknowable. So, while I'm not going to say that there is no afterlife, I will point out that for Jesus and Judaism, the tradition that he grew up in, and from which he's speaking and telling stories, the idea of the afterlife, either with a heaven to reward the righteous or a hell to punish the wicked, is not a popular one. There is very little reference to the continuation of life or our spirits beyond in the Old Testament. There's not none, of course, but there is very little, especially compared to the emphasis on the afterlife by the Christian Church ever since the Middle Ages. As well, given the obsession that many Near Eastern cultures and religions had with the afterlife, it's surprising that it's not a bigger topic for the ancient Hebrews. But there it is. Or rather, there it isn't. So, whenever Jesus talks about the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom of God, it's more than just a thought experiment to consider it a new version of life on earth in the here and now, rather than some sort of mystical other form of existence. Perhaps Jesus was after a better way of living now, rather than providing fire insurance for the next life. Maybe when Jesus talks about loving your enemies and being kind to those who persecute you, about loving your neighbor as yourself, he's not just giving instructions that will make sure fewer sins show up on some cosmic ledger that will be balanced when we die. Perhaps Jesus was talking about the heaven and hell we find on earth, the heaven and hell we make for others and for ourselves, through our choices, through how we treat others, through how we spend our money, through who we vote for, through where and how we spend our time, through how we live, who we love, who we hate, and how we perform these actions. This is less about a utopian ideal than a pragmatic adjustment within the reality of human failings. It's not about the abolition of inequity through top-down deconstruction and rebuilding, but rather a shift in how we operate within the system that is at its core unbalanced. To return to the parable, there is no instructive moment that prescribes that the entire field should be torn up and rebuilt so that there are no more rocky patches or weedy areas or a pathway, but only fertile soil where every seed can flourish. That sort of prescription leads very quickly to something like totalitarianism, wherein ruling bodies use violence and coercion to bend a population into some determined societal shape. It never really works out that well. Jesus even acknowledges the inevitability of an imbalanced society later in the book of Matthew, when he tells Judas that the poor will always be with you. After Judas complains about a woman using expensive perfume to anoint Jesus. Sometimes when I read this story, it's not the simplest story. Because I know sometimes when I read it, I think Jesus is being a little bit unreasonable. What Judas is saying does make some sense, until you take a few things into consideration. First, yes, Judas is being altruistic and very generous, or at least he's performing generosity. But he's doing it with somebody else's money. Judas didn't pay for the perfume, nor did anyone else in Jesus' organization. It was paid for, presumably, by the woman who brought it as a gift. It was her money to spend, and so it was her choice on how to use it. Judas is being a bit of a jerk when he tries to mansplain to her how to spend her own money. It's kind of like going to a birthday party without a gift, and then making everyone else feel who brought a gift feel guilty that they're giving gifts rather than donating that money to charity. Just as a side note, if you do try that, you're probably not going to get invited back next year. Secondly, Jesus, or whoever wrote the Gospels, is making a very deliberate reference to Deuteronomy, one of the books of laws that was designed by the ancient Hebrews in an attempt to make an equitable society. Now, of course, Deuteronomy is not perfect, far from it. It's definitely a product of its ancient times. However, in chapter 15, just before a passage about how you should treat your slaves, there is a paragraph about how ancient Israelites were to treat those who were financially poor in their midst. So I'm going to read this. I've cut out a little bit of it just because it sort of goes, you know, as a lot of these Deuteronomy passages, there's a lot going on in there. And so I'm just trying to focus it down into the core of it. So this is what it writes. Deuteronomy 15, 7 to 11-ish. If there are any poor Israelites in your town, when you arrive in the land the Lord your God has given you, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted toward them. Instead, be generous and lend them whatever they need. Do not be mean-spirited and refuse someone a loan because the year for canceling debts is close at hand. That's a whole other topic I'm not going to get into, but this idea of Jubilee. But it continues, there will also be some in the land who are poor. There will always be some in the land that are poor. This is why I'm commanding you to share freely with the poor and with other Israelites in need. Now, there's a couple of key problems in there. It's very direct about who you should be sharing with, only other Israelites. And so there's a little bit of kind of xenophobic motifs in there, which makes sense, or which you can understand more when you know sort of the whole story about them moving into this land. But it's also important to recognize that the Israelites in this story are colonizers, and oftentimes violent colonizers. So there's all sorts of layers of problems there. However, at the root of it is this idea of generosity, which I think is important and important to consider. And so, while I don't want to put all that other stuff and say it's not important, it is, I think we can just kind of focus on this moment because this is what Jesus is referring to and this idea of generosity. So, yeah, this is what Jesus is referring to. And so his quote comes with a whole lot of cultural context that would have been important to the Israelites and the Hebrews that were living at his time when he's talking when the Gospels are written. And he's leveling that cultural context at Judas and anyone else who would come to a similar conclusion. Yes, he is clearly calling out Judas for being a jerk, for trying to spend someone else's money, but he is also acknowledging that poverty is a larger systemic issue that needs larger systemic solutions that go beyond calling out what we might see as someone else's wastefulness or greed. While there are, if not solutions, then at least possibilities for alleviating crippling poverty, a universal basic income, for instance, they require major systemic paradigm shifts that are beyond the realm of influence of most of us. The idealist in me believes that large systemic changes can and should happen, but the pragmatist understands that these changes have no chance unless we, and by we I mean a significant portion of humanity, start thinking about ourselves and the choices that we make all the time. Jesus, throughout his teaching, is pointing us towards is porting us towards a consideration of how we behave within whatever system we exist to improve each other's lives. Jesus or Deuteronomy are not condemning having nice things or people being rich. There is no implication that everyone should have the exact same things or the same amount of money all the time. That's that totalitarianism I was talking about. There will always be rich and there will always be poor. What Jesus, through his reference and throughout most of his teaching, is calling out is how we operate within the privilege that we have, whatever that might be. So I'm going to think about a few ways that privilege works in our world. I'm going to go from the most extreme to sort of the most common. So if we are part of the wealthiest 1%, which I definitely am not, how do we use what we have to make a better life for others and not just for ourselves? Especially those others, read employees, that make it possible for us to be so obscenely wealthy. If we don't happen to have a skin color, gender identity, or sexual orientation that is treated with derision or outright hostility by religious leaders, police officers, or politicians, just three examples, how do we not only empathize, but amplify the voices and the plights of those that do? If we've had the privilege to make it through life so far without being in an abusive relationship, without being the victim of rape or sexual harassment, without having to have had a divorce or an abortion, how do we treat those that have? Are we helping them work through, or are we helping them work through or relive their trauma? Are we being empathetic or judgmental, either explicitly through personal interactions or implicitly through things like social media? If we grew up financially comfortable or at least secure, and had parents that provided us with every opportunity to pursue our goals, whether they be sports or music or higher education, how do we look at those that grew up without that security? And moreover, how do we feel about initiatives, whether governmental or charitable, that look to us for money or time to support a more equitable society? If we are privileged enough to be able to partake in the conveniences provided through tech companies, do we, provided that we are able-bodied, healthy, not in a pandemic, choose to be minorly inconvenienced in order to ensure not only fair payment for goods and services, but also to recognize the humanity of those that many corporations would like us to view as little more than faceless labor? Now, please note that I'm using the pronoun we very deliberately, not only to make it clear that I am asking these questions of myself as much as anyone else, and that I am as guilty of things as anyone else, but also to emphasize that the detrimental effects I'm referring to are the result of collective actions, not just it's individuals doing things as a collective. So obviously there are a lot of issues that arise when we start to think about inequality and privilege. So I want to narrow things down just a little bit, just in the interest of not being here for the entire day. Just, we'll be done by 2 o'clock, I swear. Watch the numbers drop. Yeah, not that long. I want to return to the idea of poverty in particular and how we interact with one particularly stubborn myth about persistent income inequality. And that is the myth of hard work. The idea that hard work always equals success and that there are no prevailing circumstances beyond anyone's control that could deny that equation from playing out in reality. We've all encountered this idea, and I'm going to make a couple statements here that are purposefully, not necessarily inflammatory, but, you know, it might get your back up. So please don't take these out of context. So we've all heard ideas, people say things like, the homeless are homeless because they're lazy. Indigenous people would go find jobs and integrate into society, whatever that means, if the government would just stop giving them handouts. You're depressed? Go do some real work. You'll be too tired at the end of the day to be sad about nothing. Again, please don't take those out of context. Conversely, the other end of the spectrum, we can think of people who say things like, nobody helped me make my millions. I did it all on my own and I deserve every penny I've made. Or you can accomplish anything if you just put in the work. If you fail, it's because you didn't work hard enough. I'm sure we've all heard these phrases or variations of them. If we're foolish enough to read internet comment sections, we've likely encountered them even this morning. And I want to explore this idea a little bit more using a slightly newer parable. So now we're going to turn to Hemingway. Now, The Old Man and the Sea is the book we're going to be dealing with. Is, you may have guessed, the story of an old man and the sea. The old man is Santiago, an elderly Cuban fisherman who's gone 84 days, as the book starts, he's gone 84 days without catching a fish. Now, Santiago is fishing in the Gulf Stream just north of Cuba. So when we talk about fish, these aren't, you know, catfish that you get from the Red River, but rather big game fish like marlin or tuna. He is, as the book puts it, profoundly unlucky and quite literally starving to death. The people of the village see him, but his poverty makes him a social pariah for fear that his bad luck will rub off. The only person who cares for him, truly cares for him, is a young boy named Manolin, who used to fish with him. After 40 days without a fish, however, Manolin's parents no longer allow him to go work for Santiago. Despite his terrible record and emaciated condition, Santiago takes his boat out on day 85 and manages to hook a marlin. Now, it's important to note that Santiago's boat is not what one would typically think about as a deep sea fishing boat. Hemingway describes it as a skiff. There's no engine, no mounted fishing rods, no fly deck providing shade. There's a small mast and sail and two oars. There's no rod or reel. There's only the old man's hands and back. So when he manages to hook a marlin, he cannot simply reel it in or use the boat's engines to slow it down, as if it's ever that simple. Instead, the marlin drags him and his boat around the Caribbean Sea for 2 days and two nights until it tires and comes to the surface. Santiago is able to harpoon the fish, but is astounded to find that it is 18 feet long from the nose to the tail. This is, of course, a blessing and a curse for Santiago, since it means a lot of money once he gets it back to land, but it also means that it's too large to bring into his boat. He manages to strap the fish to the side of the skiff, but he is a long way from the shore, and the fish is bleeding into the water. Within an hour, the first sharks, smelling blood, arrive to get what they can of this marlin. The rest of Santiago's journey back is marked by frequent shark attacks. At first, he is able to use the harpoon to stop them, but he loses that and is left with only a club to beat back the sharks, as they bite off large chunks of the marlin. Santiago is entirely helpless to stop them and uses the wind and oars to move as quickly as possible back to the shore. Sorry, I didn't say spoiler alert at the beginning, but again, as I said in the blurb, if a book's 70 years old, I think we've closed the window on spoiler alerts. In the end, his efforts amount to nothing. Despite 2 full days of being pulled around in the ocean, subsisting on a small bottle of water and raw dolphin meat, despite having the skin of his hands and shoulders torn to shreds by fishing line, despite his valiant efforts to fight off sharks, he has nothing to show for his work. The sharks have devoured the marlin, leaving only its backbone and head. Santiago is just as poor as he was when the novel started. Hemingway, I think, in one of his best passages, describes Santiago's return to his cabin in the following way. I'm just going to read this. When he sailed into the little harbor, the lights of the terrace were out, and he knew everyone was in bed. The breeze had risen steadily and was blowing strongly now. It was quiet in the harbor, though, and he sailed onto the little patch of shingle below the rocks. There was no one who could help him, so he pulled the boat up as far as he could. Then he stepped out and made her fast to a rock. He unstepped the mast and furled the sail and tied it. Then he shouldered the mast and started to climb. It was then that he knew the depths of his tiredness. He stopped for a moment and looked back and saw the reflection from the streetlight and the great tail of the fish standing up well behind the skiff's stern. He saw the white naked line of its backbone and the dark mass of the head with the projecting bill and all the nakedness in between. He started to climb again, and at the top he fell and lay for some time with the mast across his shoulder. He tried to get up, but it was too difficult, and he sat there with the mast on his shoulder and looked at the road. A cat passed at the far side going about its business, and the old man watched it. Then he watched the road. He finally put the mast down and stood up. He picked the mast up and put it over his shoulder and started up the road. He had to sit down 5 times before he reached the shack. Inside the shack, he leaned against the mast and the wall. Inside the shack, he leaned the mast against the wall. In the dark, he found a water bottle and took a drink. He lay down on the bed. He pulled the blanket over his shoulders and then over his back and legs, and slept face down on the newspapers with his arms outstretched and the palms of his hands up. So now, that's the sort of passage that high school English teachers tend to salivate over, because it's a great way of to teach literary illusion. Am I right about that, Zach? Clearly, Hemingway is presenting Santiago as a Christ figure, carrying the mast of his boat up the hill like Jesus carried the cross to his crucifixion. Don't worry, again, spoiler alert, Santiago does not die at the end of the book. But the somewhat heavy-handed imagery does make a point about the greater theme that Hemingway is exploring throughout the book, specifically the idea that despite Santiago's enormous efforts and willing sacrifice of his body, he remains a poor old fisherman. Hemingway is emphasizing the idea that Santiago can be read as a sacrificial figure. Yet, the amount of effort he exerts, the level of his sacrifice, does not translate into success. Santiago is no further ahead than if he had just stayed home. He is still poor, but the book is making the point that his poverty is not the result of a lack of effort. There were other factors, specifically sharks, that rendered his work meaningless in terms of financial reward. He could not have worked any harder, and yet he has nothing to show for it but an 18-foot marlin skeleton stripped of its meat. Now, the metaphor of the sharks is an easy one to apply to the world we live in. There are clearly those who work very hard for very little pay, and so cannot ever hope to have the wealth and success that capitalism promises to everyone who works hard. It's one of Western culture's biggest myths that any circumstance is surmountable with enough effort. Not every circumstance is surmountable. Think of those who spent years building a small business only to see it wiped out by the pandemic. It has nothing to do with how little they worked or how hard they worked. But some are beatable. The sort of corporate greed that means the people who work at Walmart, people who work at Walmart, for as one example, cannot afford to shop at Walmart. Or the sort of systemic racism at the heart of our institutions that is being protested right now. Those are all sharks. They're scary. They seem invincible. They make it seem like even trying is futile. They're not necessarily insurmountable, but it's going to take a lot of work by people working together for the betterment of everyone, not just themselves. People who are invested in the sort of message Jesus is talking about. The good news, the gospel, the kingdom of heaven. Maybe the kingdom of heaven is not a place where everyone is free from imbalances that allow some to thrive and others to fail, but a place where the failure of some is not the direct result of the success of others. Why is, as an example, Jeff Bezos worth $166 billion? A lot of it has to do with how little he pays those who work hardest for him, specifically the faceless labor working in the fulfillment centers. That's a really loaded term. Bezos and the many CEOs just like him benefit disproportionately by keeping costs down. While it's easy to blame corporate greed, we too have to consider our own roles in inequality. What does our betterment cost somebody else? I can only speak for myself. My own complicit actions when I'm lured in by slightly lower prices, free shipping, and an abundance of convenience. Through my Prime membership, yes, I have a Prime membership. Very complicated relationship with my Prime membership. And my own purchasing habits, I enable and even encourage the main focus of most tech companies, whether that's Amazon, Skip the Dishes, or Superstore Click and Collect, which is the erasure of people and the minimization of the work that they do. If humans remain out of sight, it is believed, their labor, the amount they're paid, and their working conditions will remain out of mind to the average consumer. Now, I'm obviously picking on one specific consumer iteration here. There are problems with any form of consumerism, but it is the world that we live in. It's important to note, however, that there are less problematic and damaging options out there. Shopping local, small businesses, things like that. But I'll stop banging that drum. Instead, as I sort of wrap up here, I want to go back to my lawn and to the parable of the sower. I'm happy to report that the bizarrely symmetrical patch of dead brown grass has come back to life. You may not be surprised to learn that it was only after I halted my initial campaign, which was made up of ignoring, bad-mouthing, complaining, you know, giving the grass dirty looks whenever I walked past, when I stopped doing all of that and actually and began seeding, watering, pulling weeds, and generally paying a bit of attention, that my lawn came back to life. It's funny how that works. Now, in the general understanding of the parable, the sower is meant to represent Jesus and therefore a God figure. And as tempting as it is to think of myself in God-like terms, I think it's more useful to rethink the paradigm a bit. I get the feeling that that was Jesus' whole point anyway. Instead of thinking about God in a top-down, hierarchical, king and subject way, we could think of our relationship with the divine as something that happens in between, in the temporal, in the here and now. Perhaps God, whatever God is not some separate sower, far above tossing down seeds. If God is love, as Christ tells us, then perhaps God is what happens when we show love, when we feel love, when we act out of love to make a better world. A world where the haves and the have-nots are not pitted against each other, with a discourse that says that what we have is what we deserve, that success or failure are indicators of justice, that the pie is only so big, so get what you can and keep what you've got. Maybe God is in the places where people care about each other's well-being, where we recognize each other's humanity, and we do so in ways that play out every day, even if it's not convenient. At the end of The Old Man and the Sea, it's the young boy, Manolin, who finds Santiago in his bed. He uses his meager means to buy the old man food and coffee and stays by his side to nurse him back to health. As a contrast, Hemingway uses a few paragraphs right at the end to focus on a group of wealthy tourists who see the Marlin's remains from a cafe patio. A waiter tries to explain what happened, but the language barrier keeps them from understanding. All these tourists see is the remains. They do not acknowledge the humanity of the old man whose enormous efforts resulted in what appears to be little more than abject failure. Any one of those tourists could easily have bought Santiago a meal, could probably have fed him for a month, actually, without even noticing a loss of money. They have the wealth and privilege to make a better world, but they don't even know he exists. He does not occupy the same world they do. And this isn't just about money. It's easy to quickly switch to thinking about money. What we're really considering is attitudes, perceptions, awareness, advocation, and activism. I'm not saying that the rich tourists should feel that they have to share their money, their time, or their compassion. But it seems to me that in the kingdom of heaven, or at least for those who try to operate by its principles, those with plenty might just want to. Yet it is the young boy who gives everything he has to save his friend, to recognize the humanity of a loser, to live out the good news as he does unto others, loves his neighbor, and thereby creates the kingdom of heaven on earth.